Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolves. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, KEYS. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.
And through the whole experience of the BDSM session, there's only one thing you have to say in practice. In every moment, it's yes, mistress. I accept. Thank you. Every moment of pleasure, pain, degradation. It's that practice. Yes, I accept. Thank you. I accept being tortured by this reality. I accept this chaos that I can't control. And I'm finding a way to say thank you because I'm seeing something that I couldn't see before. I know myself more deeply now. I know myself. I know my limits. I know how limitless I can be. I know how soft these spaces are, this boundary is, when I could be pushed. And something happens when you can find your pleasure and pain, your freedom and bondage, and your power and submission.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Colette, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure to have you here. So I found out about you by way of one of our former guests, Amy Chan, who wrote this amazing book about heartbreak. And I saw that she had shared something about a program that you guys were doing together. And I was incredibly intrigued about it. So I thought, okay, well, I'd like to talk to you as well. But before we get into all of that, given the nature of your work, I thought I would start by asking, what social group were you a part of in high school? And what impact did that end up having on where you've ended up and the choices you've made with your life and your career?
What social group? I felt like I was kind of this person that went in and out of many social groups. So I was kind of, I held like an office position in every club in high school, except for like Black Student Union and Latin Society. And I hung out with the jocks sometimes. I hung out with my nerdy friends. I hung out with my Asian gangster friends. But I honestly didn't feel like any of those groups were my group. And I was looking for like the group of weirdos to hang out with. And like the weirdest group in school were like the thespian goths. And I didn't feel like that was quite my vibe. And so for, I'd say most of high school, I was like blending in with as many groups as I could, but never felt like I was truly a part of it. And it was my group until I connected with another weirdo in high school who had a crush on me. And then we started dating. It was my first boyfriend. And he brought me to this place in Orange County called Coos Cafe. And this is where all the misfits of Orange County convened and made music and made art. And all of a sudden, it was like the senior year of high school. I was like, oh my God, I found my group. It wasn't in high school. It wasn't in my physical high school, but it was in this place that just had the most awesome weirdo kids that I felt like was my tribe.
Yeah.
It's funny because, you know, like the OC is one of my favorite TV shows of all time. And, you know, you're describing basically the opposite of what I probably saw on TV. I mean, I grew up in Southern California as well. So, you know, I know it well, but I'm from Riverside, which, you know, people in Orange County basically consider the ghetto from what, you know, was portrayed on that show. You mentioned that you didn't really find your people until, you know, you found this sort of group of weirdos. And we have a lot of parents who listen to this show. And I always wonder, you know, for people like you, you know, who, you know, found this group of weirdos that you connected with, if parents are listening to this, what would you tell them about, you know, having their kids sort of find their people in high school? Because I certainly didn't in high school. I think, you know, I was a band geek, but that was more out of, you know, necessity or proximity, not necessarily, you know, true connection.
What would I tell parents to? Probably just to explore their, like, what activates and excites their child. Like, what is it that really turns you on? And it's, you know, it's not what most parents tell their kids when they're in school, right? It's just like, do your homework, get good grades. But really, it's like, what excites you? And like, I know at the time I was this overachieving valedictorian, but there was this other side of myself that wanted to explore like weird things. And that was before the internet. And all we had was, you know, TV, films, and MTV and music. And so I went deep into exploring cinema and alternative music, and that was my outlet. And I think that was how I tried to find my friends. I was like, are you into the same things I'm into? And the people in high school weren't. And when I found the group who were into, you know, similar music, similar art, similar films, I was like, oh, this is my tribe. And so just as I would say the advice is explore what excites you and what makes you feel like this is resonating with you, and go deeper in that space and find people who also are interested in the same things you are. And that's how you could speak your common language with them and find your tribe and feel connected.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you mentioned that you're this, you know, overachieving, you know, valedictorian type bad. That makes me wonder what the narrative about careers was around your household growing up. You know, what kind of advice did your parents give you about, you know, what paths to pursue in life?
Well, you know, I'm Vietnamese American, and my parents were refugees. And so, as you can imagine, they're conservative, they're traditional, and their model of what successful is becoming a doctor, a lawyer, something that they could tell all the relatives.
I'm Indian, so I can relate.
Something very stable, secure, and has a high status at that time. And so that was the model of what success was, looking to, you know, our cousins who all finished med school and were established doctors. That was kind of the pillar of success.
Yeah. So there are a couple of things that I wonder, you know, when it comes to being raised by immigrant parents, because there are a lot of things that I thought were a pain in the ass about the way that my parents raised me. You know, in our household, probably much like yours, nobody, you know, puts your report cards on refrigerators for getting straight A's. That's just what they expect. You know, it was like you go to the best damn school you can get into. And there are pros and cons to that in my mind. Like, the significant upside to that is my parents taught me the value of intrinsic motivation, which has been instrumental later in my life. And of course, the downside to that is that you end up really kind of, you know, chasing other people's dreams and, you know, measuring your life with other people's yardsticks. So I wonder for you, what were the pros and cons of being raised, you know, by immigrants?
Pros and cons. Well, yeah, no, I think in the same vein as yours, it's that intrinsic motivation, right? Just seeing how much my parents have sacrificed so that I would have this opportunity. I mean, they immigrated on a boat that was a life or death situation. And I was born here in the U.S. and now I have all these opportunities to be do whatever I want to do. Or even, as I'd say, you could even be, you know, the president of the United States because you're a citizen here. And so I really felt like, yeah, there was a lot of pressure to succeed, a lot of pressure to not let my parents down, a lot of pressure to, just be the best. And And I'm glad that I have that intrinsically. No one like motivated me in high school other than myself to become like the overachieving valedictorian. I was the one who pushed myself to the point where my mom was even a little bit worried about my like craziness of like getting like an A minus, right? So I'd say that is the pro, like just being able to see how much our parents have sacrificed for us so that we would have this opportunity and we're going to make the most of it. And I think the cons of it is that is they have certain ways of defining what success is. And every generation is different in what success looks like, right? And back then in the 80s and 90s growing up, success was like a very stable career. Right. And back then it was like lawyer, doctors, you know, professor, whatever it is that had like high status was successful. And we know now that that's different in this generation. It's like you could be an entrepreneur, you could be an influencer, you could be a creative, and you could find your own success. But following that path, that is something that's a deviation from what your parents think, is a betrayal of what they want for you. But I think that that's like the path of every daughter and son of an immigrant parent. You betray your parents, but ultimately you will find a way to show them that you are doing what they want for you, which is to create a life where you are filled with abundance and wealth, material, spiritual, emotional. And you'll show them that there's another way that looks different from what they thought, but it's your own unique way.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Well, speaking of your own unique way, what happened after high school? Where did you go? I mean, I don't imagine you to go from being the valedictorian of your high school to doing what you do today, which we'll get into.
Yeah. So what happened? Well, I graduated in the year 2000, which was also the inaugural year of when Bill Gates and Melinda Gates created their Millennium Scholarship. And so I was a Bill Gates scholar. And that scholarship paid for all of undergrad, full ride. And then at some point, they also announced, like, they're like, well, we'll also pay for grad school if you go into one of these five domains. And it was like computer science, science, math, library science, and education. And all the other sciences wasn't quite resonating with me because I wanted to be like an artist. But I was a psych major at UCLA and I was minoring in education. So I was like, well, education feels like a space I could explore. And if I get a full ride scholarship to graduate school, why not? I have no other plans after college. And so I went to grad school at Berkeley in the Department of Education. And in my first year of being a grad student, I just knew I didn't want to be a poor grad student because when I was an undergrad, I was dating a graduate student and he was like poor and miserable and just always complaining about like how he just didn't have enough. And so I knew that I didn't want to be what he was doing. And so I wanted a side gig. And a couple of my friends from undergrad at UCLA moved up to the Bay Area at the same time. And two of them started working at this house of domination called The Gates. And one of them didn't have a good experience at all. The other one did. And she just told me about her day at work one day. And she described what she did to me over like soup or something. And she's like, yeah, I tied a guy up. I put nipple clamps on him. I flogged him. I put a strap on and I don't know if we could use certain words here, but
go for it.
Okay. Yeah. So she put a strap on and fucked him in the ass. She pissed on him and then she got paid and she used that money to pay for my soup for lunch. And as she was paying for it, she, had to break a $100 bill. And she was like, yeah, it's my new problem now. I have to break these hundreds wherever I go. And I was just like, whoa, okay. I want that story. I'm like, I want to tell stories like that. That's so cool that that's like another day at the office for her. And yeah. I want that problem of breaking $100 bills wherever I go. And so I went in for an interview at the Gates and started shadowing sessions. And soon enough, I was working at the Gates and also funded by Bill Gates. I felt like for a period of time, I was like, everything related to the Gates is funding my life right now. So yeah, and that's how I became a dominatrix.
Wow.
And yeah.
I was a Berkeley undergrad, so believe me, I get the experience of being poor and being in Berkeley. Not a pleasant place to be poor because it's not a pleasant place in general. So obviously numerous questions come from this. I've had, a porn star as a guest. We had a professional courtesan as a guest. I think we've had a dominatrix as a guest. I believe Kasia Urbaniak, if I remember correctly.
Oh, yeah. She was a former dominatrix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess the first place I want to start is, kind of overcoming the stigma of this. I mean, you are, raised by these sort of traditional immigrant parents who have this definition of success of doctor, lawyer, engineer, and you go from grad school at Berkeley to becoming a dominatrix, which is really, as far off the beaten path as you could possibly get. And I mean, that's a ship that's, sailed really far off course. So I guess the first thing is to sort of address, how do you deal with the kind of cultural stigma that would come with something like that? Because I know in an Indian family, if anybody found out that, somebody was doing something like that, it would be the talk of the town and there would be no end to the amount of bullshit that that person would have to deal with.
Right. Yeah, no, I hid what I did from my family and academia for a really long time. And I think 6 years into it, I told my sister about what I did and she was worried about me and we always kept each other's like secrets. And so I felt like it was safe with her. But like 4 years later, 10 years into being a dom, my sister outed me to my mom. And that was one of the most challenging experiences in my life because, the way my sister framed it to my mom just made it sound like it was a horrible thing I was doing where I was hurting men, assaulting them, or I might get assaulted, I might get arrested. And they were just afraid for my life. And they wanted me to quit. And my mom was just so, so upset and so sad. And she told me how she, she waited a month knowing this news, like after my sister outed, she waited for me to come home to tell me in person what she knew. And that whole month, she's like, I couldn't sleep. When my sister told her, she said like her insides felt like it was just like, just felt like she was just being like, just gutted. And it's, you know, the most painful experience because, you know, as an immigrant child, as you know, like you just live to like make your parents happy and proud and not be worried about you. And for the longest time, I was the golden child. My mom was so proud of me, told, you know, all her relatives about all my accomplishments. And now I'm like the shame of the family. No one can know about this. And she's just worried for me and wants me to quit. And that was, you know, such a painful experience to see the disappointment in her and just to know every day that she's worried about me. And I had to choose between, it felt like at that point, that ultimatum of like, you have to quit. And I just didn't want to. I just knew that this life that I created for myself, this unique path and all the relationships that I cultivated with my subs, it was just too beautiful and too perfect to let go of. And so I made a promise to myself that I'm going to continue doing this work, but I'm going to also make my mom proud of me. And I know that up until that point when I was hiding all of this, I was perpetuating the misconceptions of what a dom was, what sex work was, by not telling my family about what I did. They were filled with misconceptions about this world. They thought it was awful and unsafe when it's the complete opposite. It's beautiful, filled with light and love, and completely safe. And so I just made it a personal mission of mine to be completely out, dispel misconceptions, put my voice out there, and share with the world what I think this space is. And I think it's filled with a lot of truth and beauty. And that was what inspired me to create Pervette.com, which was initially a community blog where a lot of doms and subs would write in about their experiences. The first theme was about secrets, coming out, being outed. And so, yeah, I think that's kind of, wait, what was the question again?
Yeah, you answered it perfectly, and you set up the segue perfectly. So let's talk about the misconceptions that people have about sex work, because you know, I think that you know, one of the things that I really enjoyed when we had Sarah Vandella, the porn star here, was, you know, really kind of, you know, like destigmatizing the entire idea of the adult film industry and giving us a reality check, because I think you're right. Based on sort of, you know, what our cultural narratives are, particularly here in America, you know, sex work is, you know, frowned upon, it's stigmatized, you know, and it's basically one of those things where there's just tremendous social stigma. But what are the misconceptions that one, people have about the work that you do? And then let's get into the misconceptions after that about people have about the people that are your clients.
Mm. I think the misconceptions that people have about being a dominatrix, are you talking about misconceptions about sex work or?
Yeah, but I mean, both. I mean, both being a sex worker or dominatrix. I mean, in your case, you know, dominatrix, like what are the misconceptions that you think that are perpetuated by media, you know, by people who don't know anything about this, but just people who see it from the outside?
Yeah, I think it's one of the misconceptions is that this work is unsafe and that you don't know who you're going to meet and deal with in it. You may run into situations where you're put in danger. And I think that what people don't know about these sessions is that before even a BDSM session begins, there's a heavy amount of screening and negotiation that happens. And it's both the dom and the sub are choosing very carefully who they want to play with. You choose you choose each other as you would like a partner, right? Someone that you find attractive, someone that you find for a sub, someone that you look up to and trust to take you somewhere that you can't go alone. And with the Dom, it's someone that you feel is sincere and honest with their intentions and their feelings and their fantasies. And before a session begins, you negotiate and you create a safe space for each other to share what our desires, what our limits are, and what the feelings that come up from these experiences. And so there's a lot of communication that is happening before the session and throughout the session. And so that's the safe space that's being created to make this work really, really safe.
Well, you know, I mean, I think for me, another misconception is that the types of people who end up in, you know, a situation, sins like this or jobs like this are, you know, broken, come from screwed up families. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a high school valedictorian who is a Berkeley grad student, which completely flies in the face of that. So what misconceptions do you think that people have about people who do this kind of work?
Like it could, as you said, like those misconceptions also exist where it's like, oh, you must not have any other, like, this is a last resort of like making money, or you're doing it just for the money. Or there must be something broken about you. That's why you're doing this work. And it's quite the opposite. I think it's someone who really knows themselves and knows their desires and knows their worth of their time, right? Like, in this work, you get to have so much freedom to see who you want to see, when you want to see them, how you want to see them, and how much you want to charge per hour for your time. And I think that those who are gravitating towards this work are those who just value their time, know themselves and their desires, and are completely okay with saying, with being, with not caring what others think about this work. It's like, I don't give a fuck that you think that I'm crazy or broken. It's like, I know what I want. I know that this is something that's really exciting and activating and makes it feel like every day I'm not working, I'm just playing. And that's the greatest hack.
Yeah. So I love this idea of not caring, you know, what other people think. And I think that, you know, for creatives, that's incredibly relevant, because if you are constantly living your life, you know, in pursuit of, you know, the opinions of people who will never live with the consequences of your choices, you can't do anything interesting or extraordinary. Yeah. And I wonder how people, you know, apply that to their lives, regardless of whether we're talking about the kind of work that you do or not. I mean, how can they take the lessons from what you do and apply it to other areas of their life?
Yeah, I think that's, that's kind of the journey, right? The experience of really not looking around, but looking inward to finding your compass and trusting your intuition of where you ought to be and what you should be doing. Because if you look around and see what everyone else is doing, then you're just following the mainstream. And there is no creativity in that. There is just a lot of structure and monotony. And I think that that's our creative challenge of our time, like everyone's life. This is what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to figure out our own unique path. And all you could do is really not think about what others would think. It's about how you feel. How do you feel waking up every day and knowing that this is your work? Are you excited about it? Or do you feel like, oh, fuck, it's another day, right? And it's about, I really think it's about getting out of your head and really not caring what others think and just really tuning into how you feel and letting that be your compass.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
As creators, we're always on the move. Whether it's a live podcast event, a pop-up shop, or a workshop, we're constantly interacting with community, and that's where Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe comes in. Imagine this. You're at a live event, a listener loves your merch, or a participant wants to sign up for your course on the spot. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, you can accept their payments right there and then, right from your iPhone, so there's no extra hardware or no delays. Total game changer. It's not just for creators. Any business owner can do this. It's about making transactions smoother and much more personal, growing your business in your way. We've been using Stripe for our products and courses for a long time, and now, with Tap to Pay on iPhone, you can take your business to the next level too. So visit stripe.com/tapiphone to learn more. Remember, folks, with Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, your business is always at your fingertips.
Yeah. So tell me what a typical day in your life is like. And you know, what is a typical one of these sessions like?
Well, there is no typical day at all. They're all different. And but let's see. I mean, one day I could be, well, I like to wake up and have a spiritual practice of prayer and meditation, journaling, and making my matcha latte with all my adaptogens in it. So that's a ritual. But everything after that is pretty, it's different. And some days I have sessions that are BDSM sessions with clients. Some days I have intimacy coaching sessions, where I take people on a journey into new spaces as well. And, I lead people onto psychedelic journeys. I sometimes carve out days where it's completely unstructured. There's nothing on my schedule. And those are my favorite days. I call it my impromptu tuition days. And it's just completely, everything is impromptu and intuition based. Well, what do I feel like? And it feels like I'm asking my inner child, how do you feel? What do you want? And she just tells me what she wants to do. And she's just like, let's read this book. Just open this book randomly and read this page. Okay, now put it down and then get in the car, start driving. Okay, park wherever you find parking. And then like, it's just, I feel like I'm listening to my inner child and she leads me on this like magical journey throughout the day. And because it's like completely unstructured, it leaves a lot of room for serendipity, synchronicities to happen. And on some of those days, I'm like, wait a second, that was in my dream I had the night before at this book. I'm like, oh wow. If I didn't have this like completely open day, I wouldn't be led to things that my unconscious are pushing me towards.
Yeah. So there are two things I'm curious about. The intimacy coaching session and a BDSM session. How do those two things differ? I mean, obviously, they're probably dramatically different, but, you know, and then I wonder, what are the misconceptions we have about the types of clients that you have? Because I think that, you know, anybody who goes to see a sex worker, that's not something anybody wants to admit. Like, it's not something that you openly talk about. And it's, you know, in a lot of ways, something you'd never want any female friend of yours to know about, because it's so stigmatized, particularly here in the US. And I remember in other countries, I don't remember where it was, but there are countries where literally fathers take their boys to prostitutes to lose their virginity.
That's so cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'd say the difference, there's similarities, and then there's, qualitative differences too. So the BDSM sessions take place in my dungeon, which is dark and has all the equipment and the toys. And we explore erotic fantasies and realize them in that space. And the intimacy coaching sessions take place in my home, which I call the goddess pad. And it's filled with a lot of light and space, and it's tucked away in nature. And with BDSM sessions, you can imagine it's pretty kinky, involves all the toys and fetishes and all those things that are kind of typical of a BDSM session. The intimacy coaching is my own special blend of work, where I work with my clients who I don't work with like issues or problems that come up. I work with their dreams and their desires. Tell me what you want for your life. Tell me what you want deeply for your relationships, for your work and career. And they share with me all of themselves, their story, their desires. And when we get together, it's a 3 to 5 hour journey, and we go somewhere. And sometimes there's a theme. Like for some, they're like, you know, I really want to explore having, like, one of my clients is a woman in her 50s. And she's like, I really want a college lesbian night, because I never had that when I was in college. And so we would explore that space together. And sometimes I would lead them on a journey with, working with plant medicine. And it's really hard to describe, but what I'm trying to create is this experience is that you're having an open relationship with me, and I'm here to support you in your journey of realizing your wildest dreams, because I believe that a lot of growth, deep personal growth, comes from being in relationship with someone. To mirror you, to show you your blind spots, to show you your potential. And I think that in a lot of professional settings with coaching and therapy, you don't have that intimacy of, like, you know, the person you're working with professionally isn't going to tell you directly, hey, you know, maybe you're being, you know, they're not going to tell you directly and honestly that you need to shape up, that you need to do X, Y, Z, but I'm like a friend and a lover and a partner. I'll tell you honestly what I think and feel and what's coming up and what I see. And I'm just a mirror for them.
So what about the men who come to you for a BDSM session? Are they married? Do they have girlfriends? Do they have relationships? Like, what, you know, what are they like in bed? What do we, you know, what misconceptions do we have about them?
Yeah, no, I think it's a pretty wide range. Some are married, some have girlfriends. Many are middle-aged and older. And I think that the common, if I were to like try to pinpoint like what's the most common quality in someone who is exploring or who sees a dominatrix, is that they're curious. They're deeply curious about their fantasies. And they want to explore them.
Yeah.
And they've reached a point where they know that this is something that they want to realize. Because for many people, we have lots of fantasies, erotic fantasies that excite us and activate us, but we just keep it to ourselves, and it just stays there. But it takes a certain someone to be like, okay, I want to live this out. I want to explore what it feels like to let go. And I think the reason why most of my clients are men is because the conditioning, the socialization of what it means to be a man in our society pushes us to have a very narrow bandwidth of that, pushes men to have a narrow bandwidth to allow them to be a certain way, right? Because you're less of a man if you want to cry, if you're less of a man if you are not in control and leading and initiating sexual experience, right? Yeah. But I think that most men are being denied so many experiences of fully letting go, fully being able to be guided by someone to go somewhere that they can't go alone, right? Like if you're always constantly initiating sexual encounters and experiences with your partner, you'll never have that experience of fully surrendering and following. And what does it feel to open up to someone? What does it feel to be fucked? What does it feel to be, to just not know what's going to happen next? Yeah. And I think that that's what most of my subs are desiring, that experience of the deepest surrender to their desire and to desire that surrender. Yeah. And to be able to find someone that they could trust and look up to and find attractive, and be like, okay, take me somewhere I can't go alone.
I mean, you know, in the spirit of transparency, I mean, this is what made me want to have a conversation with you, because this is one of those things I'd always been curious about. And like, yeah, you know, my roommates are like, so you're into handcuffs and other shit like that? I'm like, yes, this turns me on. But I wanted to, you know, explore it and kind of get an idea of what it's, you know, the reality is. So, okay, how much of this is sexual and how much of this is not? Like, that's one thing I wonder, like, does it lead to orgasms? Like, I'm just curious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this is a good question. And kind of one of the misconceptions that people have about DOMs, they're like, well, if you're seeing a DOM, you must be having sex with her, right? But the typical BDSM sessions, there is no sex. There is typically self-release, which is when the DOM allows a sub to masturbate and come at the end of the session. And sometimes they don't. It could be that they want to prolong the chastity and the teasing and denial and all of that. So, so I would say it's very sexual in the sessions, but it's not in the way that you think, in the common vanilla sex. It's finding all the other ways that you can be turned on and get off that isn't straight up sex. And I think that's the fun part of exploring, like, oh my God, I didn't know it'd be so hot to be pissed on. Oh my God, wow, I can't believe I just got off on that, right? And I think what happens is that, I've been thinking a lot about, well, like, why do the men that come to see me have these fetishes and fantasies and desires, right? And I think a lot of people ask that too, where they're like, why would you want to be cuckolded? Why would you want to experience being kidnapped? Or why would you want small penis humiliation? Right? Like, if you think about these fetishes, they're all the things that most men are afraid of, because it would make them less of a man if that happened to them. And I think that a lot of subs, it's not like they intentionally, consciously want this fetish. They're not going to wake up one day and say, you know what? I want small penis humiliation as a fetish. It just happens, right? Something in our subconscious just planted that seed. And now we feel like we have to scratch that itch and experience it. Yeah. And I think that that subconscious desire comes from a collective self-conscious. And this, I think that all the fetishes that are in kink is dependent on the cultural context of what it means to be a man and what it means to be masculine. So all the fetishes that we think about in kink are actually part of the collective male fear. Wow. Right? Cock and ball torture, small penis humiliation, cuckolding, all of that. That's the collective male fear. And the subs that are coming to experience this, they're saying, you know what? I want to face this fear. I don't want to run away from it for like everybody would. I want to experience this and fucking get off on it.
Wow. That makes me wonder, you know, speaking of cultural context, what did your parents teach you about sex growing up? Because Indian parents don't have sex talks with their children. I know this because I never got one. Yeah. Basically, the closest thing to it I got was when my dad caught me looking at porn, you know, in his lab. He was a professor, and this was, you know, when the internet had just started in the 90s. And as in, I've asked a lot of guys who are my age, what's the first thing that you looked at on the internet? And I think almost all of us, if we're being honest, would say porn. My dad literally came in, and this was before we had, you know, browser history and, you know, we could, you know, cover our tracks. And somehow, you know, he's like, were you looking at pictures of Pamela Anderson in my office? I was like, yes, I was.
Yeah. I mean, what my parents told me is don't have sex.
Yeah. Sounds about similar to what an Indian parent would say to their kids.
You don't want to be, you know, like, yeah, you want to keep yourself clean and pure and not be like, I can't remember the analogy of like, you know, just like something that's already like damaged or eaten or something like that. You know, there's a lot of connotations to exploring having sex before marriage. Yeah. And I was Mormon for a good 8 years too.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, I was also had that belief or idea that I shouldn't have sex until I was married. So. Hmm.
So how does this end up affecting, you know, normal, like intimate relationships, like boyfriends and, you know, things like that for somebody like you? Because I know, you know, I remember talking to one of the women we had here as a professional courtesan is, how do you have a boundary between somebody who's a client and somebody who starts falling in love with you? And then, you know, what are your normal relationships like when you have them?
Yeah, I think it's pretty typical, or at least in my experiences, for my clients to fall in love with me. Because we're in a space where they're completely seen and understood and heard. Like, they get to share everything with me. And not only am I accepting of it, I'm excited to play with it. And we go deeper each time that we see each other in our play, in our explorations. And so it's a real relationship. Yeah. And I allow them to express that. And I mean, a lot of them in their, the heights of their pain and ecstasy, they tell me they love me. And I allow that because I think that this is what a BDSM session is. I truly think it's a microcosm of life, the experience of life. And I think that everything that happens inside the dungeon is what we're supposed to be doing outside of the dungeon, all of us, right? I think that we're all supposed to be choosing very carefully who we want as our partner, who we can trust to take us somewhere. And we're supposed to strip ourselves of all our clothes, our layers, our ego, and be seen completely. And we're supposed to say, okay, I'm going to fully let go. I'm going to surrender and just step into the unknown with you. We're supposed to not run away from the pain and humiliation, degradation. And we're not supposed to say, I want more of this and less of that, because that's not what life is. Life is just going to deliver to you whatever it thinks it needs to push you to the edge of your evolution. And through the whole experience of the BDSM session, there's only one thing you have to say in practice. In every moment, it's yes, mistress, I accept. Thank you. Every moment of pleasure, pain, degradation, it's that practice. Yes, I accept. Thank you. I accept being tortured by this reality. I accept this chaos that I can't control. And I'm finding a way to say thank you, because I'm seeing something that I couldn't see before. I know myself more deeply now. I know myself. I know my limits. I know how limitless I can be. I know how soft these spaces are, this boundary is, when I could be pushed. And something happens when you could find your pleasure and pain, your freedom and bondage, and your power and submission. You've transcended the duality of life. You've transcended yourself. And so this is the practice of what we should be doing in our lives every day. And when you step into the dungeon, it's just a very obvious, in-your-face, like, practice of that, right? Like BDSM just makes it way more obvious that this is what we're supposed to be doing, right? When we see the bondage, when we see the gag and blindfold and the golden handcuffs that's on us, we see the bondage. And when we see that bondage, we know that we have a choice to get out of that bondage if we want. We could say our safe word, we're out, right? Or we could figure our way to find our freedom and center in that bondage. But in our everyday lives, we don't see the blindfold. We don't see the golden handcuffs. We just think this is how it is. And when you don't see the choice that you have to find your way out of this bondage, that's when you're stuck. That's when you've lost your power. But in the dungeon, you see everything. You see the bondage. You see your submission. You choose it. And when you have that conscious choice, that's when you have your power. The sub has so much power. The dom has so much power. Everyone in that space has so much power because it's a conscious choice that they're both making to be in that space. But outside the dungeon, we're not being conscious of the choices that we have. We're not even conscious of the choices that we have before us because we don't even see the bondage. Because the bondage isn't as material as a gag or a blindfold or rope. The bondage is in our mind, right? It's the limits of what we think is possible. It's the judgments of others that hold us back from saying what we want to say, doing what we want to do, and being who we want to be. If we're not doing what we want to do in every moment, we have some bondage that we need to see and work through and find our way out.
Damn. Wow. That was profound and thought-provoking. So what about the other question? Boyfriends, things like that. Like, do you have normal relationships with people?
Do I have normal? If normal is monogamous, then no, I don't. Okay. I'm in an open relationship, and I have two life partners, lovers, and my first partner was my client, and we've been together in this open relationship for 7 years now, and I just love him so much. And my second partner is someone that I've been with for a year now, and he's also incredible. I both my partners are my soulmates. They are here in my life to push me to the edge of my evolution, and I didn't even believe in soulmates until I did acid with my client, my said client, 7 years ago, and the veil was lifted. This person that I didn't think was my type was exactly who I was supposed to be with. And we've been together ever since, and we have this expanding, wacky open relationship where he's currently with a friend that I've introduced him to, and they're having this beautiful blossoming relationship. And I feel like I have sister wives, and it's, just a really, beautiful polycule. And, you know, it took a lot of time to get to this place where we can have this relationship that is this expansive. It took a lot of learning how to communicate skillfully and knowing ourselves and expressing our feelings and insecurities and jealousies when they come up, right? And it's not like you could have this relation. It's not like if you're an open relationship, you have no jealousy. It's like, no, those things are there, but it's how you express it. And how you work through it and how you examine them.
Mm. You know, I think that the thing that struck me most was that you've said words being pushed to the edge of your evolution multiple times throughout our conversation. And yeah. What I wonder is how this ends up impacting, you know, other areas of people's lives. So we say a client comes to you, how does it affect their performance at work or in their business? Because if they're being pushed the edge of their evolution, I'd imagine it basically, you know, leads to incredible outcomes in other areas of life.
Yeah, no, I think that it's how one makes meaning of those experiences, right? If you could see like, oh, wow, if I could be pushed in this way, if I could fully let go in this way and expand like how I see myself And what I thought was a limit is no longer a limit. What I thought was a boundary is no longer a boundary. I think that's kind of like the skill and the craft of the dominatrix to really, you know where the sub's boundaries are and push them right to it. And just a little bit beyond, but not to the point where they would say their safe word. It's just so that they could see. It's like, oh, I thought that was a limit, but now I see that it's not, and I'm actually getting off on it, and I want to explore it a little bit more, right? And so I think that's the fun of all of this, being able to explore our boundaries and our limits and realizing they're softer than we think. You know, but if we never explore them, we always think it's a hard stop. And the key is just to create the safe space with deep trust and intimacy so that we can explore the limits and bounds of ourselves. And that what we thought was an edge, we get to be pushed a little bit further. And when you pushed a little bit further, that's the edge of your evolution as I see it. And, you know, I see it in happening in life all the time when like things happen to you that are incredibly challenging and painful. That's you being pushed to the edge. And you could choose to see it as the edge of your evolution. If you choose to see like, what am I going to learn from this deep pain and suffering? How am I going to find my way out of this suffering? Right. When you could figure out your way out of that pain, that painful experience, that painful challenge, you have unlocked a part of yourself that can take more, that can experience the depths of life, the breadth of life as well.
Wow. Amazing. Well, I have one final question for you, which is how we finish all of our interviews at the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
What do we think it is that makes someone unmistakable?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Wow. I'm going to let that question sink for a second. So what do I think it is that makes something or someone unmistakable? Is that the question?
That is the question.
It's knowing your truth. It's knowing yourself. It's doing that deep work of really exploring and getting to know every part of yourself, especially the shadow, especially the shame, especially the parts that are so painful. When you can explore the depths of yourself and get to know yourself, that you have something that you have your truth. That's, and when you can embody that truth, seek that truth and express that truth, it becomes so clear to yourself and everyone around you that you are you, that you're not looking around to figure out who you are. You just have looked so deep inside. You have let every moment, every experience of life allow you to see yourself more clearly. And I think every moment of life offers us that opportunity to get closer to our truth. And when we seek it and express it, it becomes unmistakable. This is you.
Amazing. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to join us and share your story, your wisdom, and your insights with our listeners. This has been one of my favorite conversations I've had all year.
Oh my gosh, I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and everything else you're up to?
Well, people could find me on, I have a website called pervet.com that I've been working on for 7 years now. It's still a work in progress. It's an evolving website, and it's a very intimate space where I share my dreams, my wisdoms, and I'm beginning to share my stories as well. And it's also a space where people could see what my offerings are as a dominatrix, a shamanatrix, as an educatrix. And I'm about to launch a course called Mistress Class in October, teaching women and femmes how to come into their power and become dominatrices. And you could also find me on Instagram and Twitter.
amazing. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Have you ever felt a twinge of worry about AI taking over your job or diluting your creativity? Well, what if you could turn that fear into creative fuel? We've just published an amazing new ebook called The 4 Keys to Success in an AI World, and this is more than just a guide. It's a deep exploration into the human skills that AI can't touch, the skills that are essential for standing out and thriving no matter how much technology evolved. We're talking about real differentiators here like creativity, emotional intelligence, critical thinking, and much more. Inside, you'll find actionable insights and strategies to develop these skills, whether you're a creative person, a business person, or just simply someone who loves personal development. This isn't a story about tech taking over. It's a story of human creativity thriving alongside AI. Picture this: AI as your creative co-pilot, not just as a tool, but a collaborator that enhances your unique human skills. The 4 Keys ebook will show you exactly how to do that and view AI in a new way that empowers you instead of overshadows you. Transform your creative potential today. Head over to unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. Use the number 4, K-E-Y-S. That's unmistakablecreative.com/4keys. And download your free copy.